Welcome to the Brainstorm episode 106. Today we're talking SpaceX and sequencing. May as well kick off with SpaceX. A lot of exciting things happening over the weekend. First, you had Starship test flight, which was incredibly successful. Then over the weekend, you had the 31st reuse of a booster. And I think SpaceX hit 10,000 satellites launched. I remember when we first started this endeavor looking at reusable rockets, I remember specifically there was an orbital ATK call where the CEO said, you know, reusable rockets aren't a new thing. We've looked at them and they're not economic. And here we are a decade later, 31 reuses. Brett, what was your biggest takeaway of the Starship test flight?
I mean, as with all this stuff they do, they start out and it looks impossible. And then they do something that looks like maybe it's possible, but they can do it once. And then slowly as they go, it just becomes more and more routine. The fact that they can lob this top of the rocket halfway around the world, have its fins get half burned through, and it still like come and land on the spot next to a buoy. And then over time, the fins are getting less burned through, and now they're intentionally taking heat tiles off to see if they can destroy it, and it's surviving. It's just so different from most aerospace, where it's like one little thing goes wrong and it prompts a catastrophic failure. Here, it's so clear that they're designing a more robust system. And I think of Elon's, you know, Elon has this magic formula that part of which is like, you just take out and simplify processes and remove, the best part is no part. You take out parts along the way, you make it simpler and simpler and simpler. And how different that is than the space shuttle, which was, has, you know, probably millions of complex interconnected, you know, engineering systems, all with their own engineering margin. And prospectively, the space shuttle was supposed to, I think, have on the order of a 1 in 100,000 chance of failing, but practically it had like a 1 in 100 chance of failing, or so, much to everybody's regret. Here, by taking out all those complex interconnections, because you're just focusing on the systems that matter, it seems like you can build a launch vehicle that ends up much more robust to just being bashed around by the atmosphere. So,
Oh, I was going to say, one of the things that still blows my mind, and it's just like common now, is how amazing the video is because of Starlink. And it's like, that's totally underappreciated. It's like, here's an antenna that's also going through the atmosphere and incredible. It's like better connection than, you know, a dish TV on a rainy day.
Yeah. And also that also means that they get data out of the system as they're going. So kind of the Starlink satellites are useful for me. I'm on Starlink right now because my internet's down. Useful for SpaceX in terms of, even if the rocket blows into smithereens at the end, they still are collecting all of the telemetry and optical data along the way. And ultimately, the optical data is very useful for seeing, hey, this is what's going on with the heat tiles, where burn through is happening, stuff that you can't necessarily... you can't have a sensor on every single heat tile to tell you how it's performing. And so you need kind of like that. The reason they have multiple buoys and drones, like, you know, filming it as it comes down, is not just because it looks badass. It's because you can get a better information on what's going on with the ship as it comes down.
What are the remaining obstacles from where Starship is today to where it ultimately needs to be?
Well, it needs to be on Mars. So,
so many obstacles.
Yeah. So there are many obstacles. But so this was the last iteration of this version of Starship. So they're going to move on to the next testing. So there's going to be new rocket engines. There's going to be a new Starship. It's going to keep getting bigger, is my understanding. But like a key operational element is going to be the reuse of the heat shield itself, and the in-orbit refueling. So those are, I would say, are kind of two near-term things that are going to be tested. and will open up the flight envelope quite dramatically.
Yeah. And I think the engineering challenge of making the top actually reusable coming through the atmosphere and quickly turnable is really thorny and nasty. And it would not surprise me if that, you know, from the beginning, landing a rocket, people were like, well, that's a bridge too far, like you said, Sam. And even SpaceX was like, maybe we'll get it done 2/3 of the time. Now they nail it every time. And now, you know, bringing a heat shield through the atmosphere and having it reusable afterwards just seems so impossible. I mean, you're subjecting those tiles to so much heat stress. It's hard to imagine that at the end of that, they are okay, clean, ready to go again. And it could be that that turns out to be, you know, there are some things that are, you know, beyond the scope of our ability to engineer our way out of them. You know, if they can do it, it opens up things like, you know, going from New York to Japan in an hour trip and some of the other business models they're going after. But I think even if they can't do that, they still are well on track for low Earth orbit, giant satellite constellation, and even Mars without that, I think is perfectly within reason.
Yep. And this was something we discussed, right? It's like just going from Falcon 9 to Starship, you dramatically lower the cost to orbit on a kilogram denominated basis. And you totally change what's possible because of the volume that you can put up. So both mass and volume being key elements here. And then the rapid reusability is cherry on top for a lot of other use cases.
Can you swap out the heat shield fast enough that it maybe doesn't matter for it to be fully reusable? Or is the cost of the heat shield enough that you really want it to be reusable and not something you can hot swap in and out?
I don't think the cost is that major. It's like, I think it is significant, but in terms of the whole thing, and it's like, sure, you could have right? It's like, even if you had a 1-day turnaround, if you had enough launch pads, then that's fine, right? It's like, you have to have a fleet of more rockets. I think it gets more.
I don't know. I mean, but they have to like individually glue on those tiles. I just think the promise of, if you are, Sam, this is your work, but the time it takes to turn the rocket is correlated with the expense because you have people basically working on the thing while that happens. And I would imagine if you look at the total manufacture time of the Starship, a substantial portion of it is like putting the tiles onto the rocket. And so I do think that that's...
We've got humanoid Baroque architecture, Brett Winton, saying that we're not going to have Gluer bot to solve this.
Yes, you might. I mean, I think... I guess there's a question kind of implicit. Will you be able to like look at the tiles and be like, oh, that one needs replacing, and then pluck it off and put another one on? Maybe that is like a way you could go about it.
Well, I do think it's like that's somewhat what comes back to the most incredible thing of this most recent test is it's not that they were trying to make it successful, right? This was the final push of the envelope on this version, right? And so to that point, being able to strip out tons of tiles and have it succeed, I think like the robustness of the system should lead to more rapid reusability.
Yeah, it at least means you can like fly it once, it's semi-damaged, you can fly it again and be like, okay, well, maybe we bring it back this time or not, but you know, it's at least like the heat shield doesn't matter on the going up. So if you land it, like you can at least launch it one more time, which makes a difference economically. And you know, and maybe you're just landing it knowing at some point it's going to come back in and kind of like you have it set to incinerate above the ocean rather than anywhere else.
All right, let's move on. We've got a sequencing next. Brett, PacBio, continuing to drop the cost of long read sequencing. Maybe for all of us involved. Quick primer.
Yeah.
Long read versus short read. Why one is better than the other, but the other one still has a future, maybe, maybe not. And it's already so cheap. Why isn't everyone getting it done? How come this hasn't solved all of our problems yet?
Well, is that a compound question or what? so the way gene sequencers work, and specifically Illumina's gene sequencer, which is the dominant one in the industry, it does, you know, the vast, vast majority of sequencing volume, is you take DNA, which is 3 billion letters long, you chop it into little bits because you're extracting out of the cell, it gets all broken up. And then you take all those little bits and you amplify and multiply them, and then you sequence all of those little bits. So on 3 billion letters, each bit is maybe 150 letters long. And so then once you sequence them all, you have to then use, you know, good algorithms to be like, oh, this overlaps here, and therefore these two puzzle pieces stick together. And so you reconstruct the entire sequence based upon all of the little chunky puzzle pieces. And so that works, that technology works and is inexpensive for calling individual letter base pairs and kind of, you know, things that happen over tens of letters in the genome. But you can imagine if you have a sequence that's like inverted, or you have a sequence that's repeating a number of times, cutting it into little 150 base pair fragments means that you can't tell how the puzzle goes back together. It could go back together with this fragment this way or this way. So with long read sequencing, you basically take a much longer chain. And that's what PacBio offers. And so you can see all those structural variations. And there's a lot of diseases that are probably related to that, to repeat errors. And we don't understand those diseases as well, in part because it's been so expensive and hard to measure them. And so PacBio is cutting its prices to $300 per genome for long read sequencing. Illumina at the cutting edge looks like it's around $200. You know, rewind the clock to the beginning of the, you know, the early 2000s, and it was $2 billion. So, you know, 300 versus 200 versus 2000, 2 billion, you know, this is clearly like a lot less expensive than it used to be. And so it's certainly, long read sequencing is very interesting from a research perspective. If you do research with it and you can really pin down, hey, these are diseases that are related to structural variation, then that will feed into the ability of drug developers to develop, you know, drugs to go after those specific diseases. And so then it becomes more useful to be able to diagnose them, because you're not just diagnosing them and saying, hey, this is something that's wrong. You're saying, hey, this is something that's wrong, and then here's a solution for it. But that gets to kind of like the challenge of biology. We're so early that kind of people align around a tool that generates a lot of useful information, that then they develop drugs that are aligned up against that information, or develop best practices for how to treat people lined up against that specific kind of information. And so it's hard to get everybody to shift over to a different kind of like richer data set. And so Illumina has been thus far dominant in the industry, and their short read is particularly well suited for getting DNA fragments out of blood, which is how all modern kind of cancer testing is shifting, where a cancer in your body will slough off small fragments in the blood. So it doesn't matter that Illumina's machines can only measure small fragments, because that's exactly what cancer is shifting off. And so therefore you can diagnose and really guide treatment for cancer just based on blood samples. And that's kind of like the growth area of the diagnostic industry. So PacBio's instruments are super interesting. They're undercapitalized relative to certainly Illumina. And the space has broadly been challenging. You know, we'll see if kind of like this lower cost for long read sequencing catalyzes, you know, more researchers to use it, and gets into kind of translational and clinical medicine in a more profound way.
Is the long read or short read market larger long term? As in, like, when you've modeled this out with the team, the TAM, what does it look like one versus the other?
You really have to make it's from where we are today, you would say that kind of at from where you are today, you would say short read remains dominant for some amount of time. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we should want all this information. Like, ultimately, the information you're missing by not using long read hurts your ability to understand the biology. I think the problem is our understanding of biology is so crude that there's still plenty of like juice in the lemon staying on the short read stack. And Illumina does things like, hey, you can
kind of barcode and stitch together these short reads to get synthetic long reads that aren't as good as PacBio's, but they get you some of the way there. And so I think it's hard to, you can say like at a high level, yes, we should be doing all long read. We shouldn't be leaving information on the table. But the crossover point is harder to, you can't tell when the industry is going to like recalibrate around a different set of instruments and tools. And Illumina tried to buy PacBio was ultimately stopped due to FTC stuff. So they saw this as the future. And if they had, if that had happened and it had been a consolidated entity, then maybe the transition happened sooner because they tried to shift their entire commercial customer base over. So it's really a very contingent path of technology just because how messily the monetization and kind of health stuff generally happens and how many interconnected kind of independent players there are.
All right. Let's move on to our chart parentheses S of the week. If you want to be sad, go look at Brett's Twitter about how little time you have with your children. But for the purpose of this brainstorm, we're going to go to Nick and your prediction market chart. Why this chart?
Why this chart? Well, we have for the first time on a weekly volume basis, the prediction market notional volume has eclipsed 2 billion. So, you know, we've embedded a prediction market segment into the show and we're riding a wave that doesn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon. And I think what's also interesting about this chart specifically, we had been noticing, and you see it up on the screen, you can notice that Kalshi had been taking share, or maybe it was the lack of volume coming from sports into Polymarket, but it was almost, you know, a week ago where Kalshi was, call it 70-ish% of the total market. And it looks like what has occurred in this past week has shifted we're swinging back towards a 50-50 market between Polymarket and Kalshi. So pretty interesting to see the market dynamics at play. Kalshi just launched internationally. Polymarket has been a much bigger international player than in the U.S. They've now moved into the U.S. So you're starting to see the turf war shape up pretty significantly in a very fast and dynamic moving market.
And how should we think about, like, do you think that the way the market is going to move, it's going to be at some level, and then the next election cycle, it's going to 10x, whatever that is, again? As in, will prediction market still on a, like, election, particularly presidential election basis, suddenly grow like 10x, and then that creates a new kind of base?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we're going through the work now, and Brett, I'm waiting for a response from you, so I'm calling you out publicly on how to try and dimension out the TAM, which is, you know, like if you think about politics and maybe geopolitical events, that is probably going to be some percent share of the total market. I think the more work that we do here, and as we really start to ramp on this, I really think the large opportunity is in, you know, taking away from what has historically been second order trades in the financial market. As in, you have this geopolitical event, or you have something that is being played out in the traditional market by, you know, changing your equity exposure or gathering an options position, hedging out some sort of risk using second order derivative products. As in, it's not a direct bet on the event itself. And that, I think, is a huge market long term. But it's going to come, I think the majority of the volume is going to come from the financial market and the way people play, you know, like options and futures contracts. That's all going to shift over into the prediction market. I think, like, culturally, I've seen a lot about mention markets of what is, you know, the president of the United States going to say in his next speech. All of that, I think, is interesting, but I don't know how much of it can be, you know, the majority of the volume longer term. Unless you just have, you know, AI agents trading with each other in, like, at the speed of light. I think it's more, you know, the major market and disruption is going to happen to traditional instruments people have used in the financial market that now fall over into event-driven contracts.
Yeah, and actually, I think volume is good because it's easy to measure. But the actual way in which we'll measure the economic importance of these is basically like the open interest. Like how much do people have at risk against the markets in aggregate? Because as AI agents get in, you could have volume explode, but that doesn't mean there's actually more risk on. You know, it just means that like kind of like you're at the margin keeping the contract at the right efficient price, you know, because they're, you know, buying and selling and buying and selling. And I think like I 100% agree that the reason these are interesting is because they could become profoundly financially useful for real sizable market actors. I think that if you look at Tesla, for example, we're all familiar with Tesla, you could imagine there are two sets of owners of Tesla. There is a set of owners that is basically just basing it on the next 12 months financials. And they are saying, well, I think it's going to trade at this on EBITDA, and I'm just trading that. I actually don't care about anything that happens downstream from that. And then there's another set that's like, I'm making a multi-year bet on what robotaxi is going to happen and what it's going to look like. And if you could force those actors to actually cleanly acknowledge like the other side of the bet, like if somebody could bet on robotaxi and actually hedge out the risk of what happens with deliveries and gross margin and stuff on the quarterly metrics, then you would actually get a cleaner sense and underwrite for what is built into that stock in terms of robotaxi expectations and what's built into kind of like the core EV business. And, you know, my strong belief is actually the robotaxi is poorly underwritten because there's no mechanism by which somebody could cleanly get exposure to that contract.
The trend of single stock ETFs to single component of stock.
line item ETFs, right. Single segment.
A great example given what we talked about last week, which is Elon's pay package, which is just a set of event contracts for him specifically. But if you wanted the market to also align by him, what do you do now? You as an individual go out and buy equities or options on the share price of Tesla going up. In theory, if there was enough liquidity, you could take the same exact bets that Elon is personally making with the company by signing on to the pay package and not have to worry about how the broader market attributes that to the stock price. You can just make a yes or no bet. Will there be 1 million bots delivered in X period of time, which is what Elon's doing? Like he has an event contract now, like a nested event contract now with shareholders. And
quite the parlay, if you will.
Yeah, quite the parlay.
Yeah. And I think like a way to think about financial markets is these are common knowledge generators, and it's expensive to generate common knowledge. So common knowledge is knowledge that you know that I know, and I know that you know that I know that you know it, like in reciprocally all the way down. And kind of the, at least my experience with Tesla is there's a set of actors out there on X, et cetera, who their strategic plan is to actually deny common knowledge on the robotaxi business. As in the math is so dumb, stupid, and simple that this could be massively cash flow generative that they can't even acknowledge or argue on that specific set of math because doing so would acknowledge that there's an option of huge value creation here. And so instead they kind of deny that this whole thing exists and don't engage kind of like with intellectual honesty in that discussion, because then it would force them to acknowledge that there's like a huge potential option value embedded in the stock. Now they can do that because there's no way to pin them on actually having to price it, right? Like there's no market that is specific to that subsegment of the business. And if there was, I think actually what would happen broadly, not just on Tesla, but across equities, is you would actually get more efficient pricing of longer term events. And so you would end up with actually equities more successfully discounting the future because you could extract out some of those longer term pieces, subsegments of a very complex kind of underlying company. You would basically like a very good kind of set of prediction markets wrapped around equities. Suddenly people would be like, oh my gosh, multiples are going nuts here. Why are these companies trading much more expensively than they used to? And it's because you were actually efficiently pricing some of the longer term option exposures that they have that right now go unpriced because people are like, well, is it going to affect earnings in the next 12 months? If not, I'm not interested.
All right. We stumbled into talking Tesla, but we pulled ourselves back out. I agree. I think the future, I mean, I think it's interesting. It's one of the things we always come back to is like how powerful these markets are going to be. And so we should think more about that. But that brings us to the Ledger, our weekly prediction market tally. So far, none have resolved, but I think we're tracking well. All right, this week, I was very tempted to do this Poly Market one, which was, will any of the Louvre heist robbers be arrested by October 31st? But I'm going to opt a different route here because I think not betting advice. I think this is too easy. Most art crimes get solved years after, because as long as you're not trying to sell it, it's pretty hard to get caught.
What is their strategy for monetizing this stuff? Do they extract the jewels out of like the individual pieces and sell the raw jewels? It seems like
that's probably easier than it. In college, we had is like the head of the FBI art crime division came to speak to us, and he's like, it's very easy to steal things from museums because they're not really protecting things from that, right? But it's like, if you keep it, you're fine. But then why are you risking stealing it? But as soon as you steal it, it's like the most likely buyer is going to be the FBI or international equivalent. So the topic we're going for, and Nick, we've touched on this one before, but it's relevant because Apple just paid $140 million a year for broadcast rights for the next 5 years, close to doubling ESPN, $85 million a year for F1 broadcast rights in the US. And things have started to get interesting because you have Max Verstappen coming back with a fury. And so the question is, F1 driver's champion, and do you want me to share my screen so you can see these odds and make your picks?
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Wait, we each have to pick a champion?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Got it.
And it's pretty even odds. Can you see now?
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got Oscar Piastri at 38%. You've got Verstappen at 34 and Lando at 28%.
I'm going Verstappen.
Same.
Sam, we can't be on the same side every day.
No, I'm gonna long Lando. I think one, McLaren has like a vested incentive to have him win over Piastri because Piastri is kind of an a-hole and Lando is British. And two, like he has points in hand versus Verstappen. And so I would rather just take the points in hand, assume Piastri's going to continue to get screwed by his own team, and Lando for the win.
All right, there you have it. Nick, this is our redemption bet because we called Verstappen way back.
We did.
And we never bought his playing card.
When this show was only being done live on public.
So redemption.
Max, is this like an NFT playing card or is this a physical playing
card?
No,
this was we had a guest on who was running because memorabilia still making quite a run, I would say. But we were early to the trend. Nice job, Nick. So we had someone on to discuss the market there, and we were looking, and there was a Max Verstappen card, and it's like everyone just assumed that Hamilton was going to take the season, and so we were debating whether or not to buy it, and we did not. And this and that was like the season where
he broke out.
Verstappen is so amazing. Like just in F1, you know, you drive the identical car as your teammate. So mostly the teammates finish like within a couple places of each other. And then Verstappen finishes first and whoever the other Red Bull driver finishes like 15th. It's really, he's a standard deviation better than any other driver. But that also suggests to me that— Now you're making me
feel good about, you know, our pick.
Yeah, super match.
Well, yes. Or, I mean, it's so execution sensitive to Verstappen. It seems like, I think, higher risk that he's going to continue to win races.
It's true. All that he needs is one one targeting, right? You get one driver to take him out. They get a little under the table payment from Piastri, and then that's that.
I do think Verstappen's also helped that the other teams don't really like the McLaren team, so they're not going to do them any favors. I think that that's also true.
All right. Thank you everyone for joining us for this week of the Brainstorm. We'll see everyone next week.
Thank you. ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other. And therefore, ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.